While Bill Donovan and the men and women of the OSS who worked for him were determined to see the conflict in Europe in black and white, the Germans and all who supported them were evil and the enemy. All who opposed the Axis powers were, if not good, allies. OSS officers in London admitted, however, that the French resistance was a devil's brew of politics. Within the resistance were Gaullists, conservative nationalists, followers of General Charles de Gaulle, communists, and those loyal to General Henri Girard, commander of French forces in North Africa. Each of the factions wanted to become the dominant political force in post-war France. Some Allied officers, especially the British, had feared that the well-armed resistance groups might use the Normandy landings to indulge themselves in a first-rate civil war. Moreover, the Maquis was notoriously riddled with German agents and collaborators. And so it was with Fraget's circuit, codenamed Donkey Man. Henri Fraget was a veteran of World War I who had made a name for himself as an architect during the interwar period. With the outbreak of war in 1939, he found himself once again in uniform. After the fall of France, the soft-spoken, slender, prematurely gray Fraget retreated to the countryside, and with the help of the SOE, began organizing the resistance in Lyon. By 1944, Donkey Man would include some 5,000 fighters. Fraget's right-hand man in this operation was Roger Bardet, who in 1943 had been captured by the Abwehr, a German military intelligence organization. Under the threat of torture and the death of his family, Bardet had agreed to inform for the Germans. In the months that followed, dozens of Donkey Man operatives were inexplicably captured. In February 1944, Bardet introduced Fraget to a man named Hugo Bleicher, who posed as an anti-Nazi Luftwaffe officer interested in working for the British. Fraget was completely taken in, sharing with Bleicher plans for his circuit's forthcoming operations in Lyon. On July 2nd, when Fraget stepped off a train at the Montparnasse station in Paris, Bleicher and several Abwehr agents were waiting for him. The Frenchman was executed 3 months later at Buchenwald. By the time of Team Bruce's briefing, none of these developments had come to light. "What should we do if we fail to make contact with Fraget or his men?" Colby asked presciently. The briefer seemed taken aback, as if he had never considered such a possibility. Finally, Team Bruce was given the location of a safe house to repair to, should it be unable to connect with Donkey Man. Colby and his colleagues were scheduled to take off that night from the airbase at Thamesford, but the weather closed in. The next day, they learned that Fraget had been arrested and that the new head of the Lyon Maquis was a man named Roger Bardet. He would be their contact. "We accepted the new order as simply as the first," Colby recalled, as though our announced hostess had taken sick and was replaced by a cousin. The following evening, August 14th, Team Bruce boarded a converted B-24 bomber named Slick Chick for a rendezvous with they knew not what. Only one thing was certain: the mission would be dangerous. Just weeks before, the German high command had broadcast a warning to would-be saboteurs and guerrillas: "Whoever on French territory outside the zone of legal combat is captured and identified as having participated in sabotage, terrorism, or revolt is and remains a bandit, or franc-tireur, guerrilla, and shall consequently be shot, whatever his nationality or uniform." In fact, the leader of one of the first Jedburgh teams to drop into Brittany, Major John Bonsall, had been stopped at a German checkpoint, identified, and executed on the spot. Of course, being shot might be the most comfortable fate awaiting captured Jedburghs. The men who delivered the Jedburg teams to occupied France were unique, as was their equipment. The pilots, codenamed Carpetbaggers, officially the 801st Bombardment Group, were volunteers who flew into enemy territory at very low altitude with no lights. Their planes were camouflaged with non-reflective black paint, and all but two of the gun turrets, the ones in the top of the fuselage and in the tail, were removed. Inside, The bomb racks were replaced by specially designed shelves on which sat containers holding submachine guns, grenades, explosives, radios, and boots, the paraphernalia of guerrilla war. The only light inside the B-24 was a small bulb that glowed green, furnished for the navigator so he could read his maps. Finally, ground crews covered the aperture where the belly turret had been removed with a plywood trapdoor. Colby and his mates would parachute one by one via these Joe holes, Joe being the name that Allied parachutists gave themselves, to be followed by the supply containers. At 12:45 hours, the pilot announced that the target area was in sight. He circled once, descended, then circled again at 1,500 feet to make sure he was over the correct location. Satisfied, he gave Team Bruce the go-ahead signal. The parachute snapped open with a reassuring jolt, Colby wrote in his memoirs. We were on our own now, two free Frenchmen and myself, floating down through the balmy August midnight into the heart of German-occupied France. And I suddenly realized that something was seriously wrong. The Maquis had been instructed to set three bonfires in a triangle. The flames the parachutists saw were in a straight line. Favelle thought the fires were from a burning village, but they turned out to be from a train the Allies had bombed. Colby and his mates landed not in a sparsely occupied countryside, but in a town some 25 miles short of their planned drop zone in Yon. The trio frantically manipulated their chutes to avoid chimneys and rooftops, finally coming to rest in a garden. Their landing was noisy enough, but after the men came the supply containers, which clattered down on the tiled roofs. Awakened, the residents circled around and assured the visitors that they would not be betrayed.